Lisa?
Yeah, I would like to introduce Jessica Renish. No, probably doesn't need much introduction, but she's an investigator award holder from the Wellcome Trust. She's head of the Reluctant Internationalists. She's also director of the newly launched Center for the Study of Internationalism here in Birkbeck, and she's written extensively on history of international public health and international organizations.
Thank you. So one of the things that propelled me into thinking about insiders and outsiders years ago was Patricia Clavin's call that historians of international organizations have to do much more to understand political power. As most of you know, I've been working on the history of one particular body, the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, and trying to figure out what shape such a history should take. And as part of this, and many of you have heard me talk about this before, I've been pondering the fact that international organizations such as UNRWA themselves were clearly outsiders in a way. They operated in a political and a diplomatic system that strictly prescribed their room for maneuver. UNRWA, just as many other international organizations, was only able to work for as long as its membership deemed it beneficial to work. And since 72% of its funds were paid by, came from the United States, UNRWA was ultimately shut down when it no longer secured what were perceived to be US interests. So this is a crucial, if rather obvious, facet of political, of the realities of political power and international organizations. Today I want to do something slightly different. I want to, for once, turn the gaze inwards and identify some of the processes of marginalization, of literally pushing certain groups and fields of activities to the margins or the peripheries, and some of the hierarchies at work within UNRWA and its relationships with the recipients of aid. UNRWA was one of the first bodies to be created during the Second World War, and it embodied a very self-consciously inclusive project of relief and rehabilitation. Its catchline was to help the people help themselves. But how inclusive was it really? So I want to break this down by focusing first on a little bit about on structure and on its remit, and then secondly, taking the relief workers at their word and seeing how marginalization was at work there. These are very preliminary and broad observations. So first on the remit. One of the very first obstacles UNRWA's inclusive mission stumbled over was a basic contradiction. Relief was supposed to be distributed internationally, globally, as a means of treating and eradicating causes of poverty, hardship, ethnic conflict, and war. But those countries who are politically and, of course, geographically at the center of the war were excluded from its reach. Of course, there were very clear, justifiable political and economic reasons for why the relief needs of the Allied liberated countries outrank those of the ex-enemy nations. But in practice, this line proved flexible enough to admit Italy and Austria to the ranks of allies quite quickly, and then later to include Hungary and Finland as legitimate recipients of aid as well. The German population remained ineligible until the end. There are very clear reasons for this, but UNRWA's relief workers at the start were often disconcerted by this. During their introductions, I've spent a little bit of time thinking about how they were trained and how they were introduced to the UNRWA project. And during these introductions, when they first came across UNRWA's very self-consciously global insignia, such as the badges behind you, they pointed to the holes in the globe that actually operated in practice and started to express doubts about how UNRWA's mission actually could work in practice. So outsiders of a kind were at play even before UNRWA had a chance to get started. In UNRWA's own preparations, outsiders were created by the crucial distinction between supplying and receiving countries. And again, many of you have heard me talk about this before. Again, this distinction reflected not just economic but also political realities. Few nations were entirely happy to submit to the conditions and the perceived or actual loss of sovereignty that came with foreign aid, especially if they had other options. And soon this separation between receiving and supplying countries proved too inflexible for those nations in the north and west of Europe. They were able to recover faster economically than those in the east and south, and attempted very deliberately to join the table of winners. Many smaller member states rallied against the fact that the priorities of the great powers often overrode their own, but countries such as France, Belgium, Netherlands, Denmark, and Norway were in a much stronger position to negotiate better deals for themselves and outside of the UNRWA negotiations. In UNRWA's own policymaking organs, and of course in the wider world in which they operated, the influence of the Anglo-Saxon countries, as one former official noted, was an unavoidable fact. The third member of the Big Three, the Soviet Union, was by 1943 no longer formally a pariah state, but in reality, British and American diplomats were often still unsure about how to deal with or even interpret Soviet behavior. So this is a part of UNRWA's kind of starting diplomatic setup in a way, which already had certain insiders and outsiders embedded in it. And then on top of that, many more subtle and mundane processes of inclusion and exclusion were at work behind the curtains of the big political theatre of UNRWA's General Council meetings. And I apologise in advance. In order to get our head around this, we need to have a very quick look at UNRWA's structure. And digressions into UNRWA's structure are extremely tedious. And in UNRWA's own material usually result in something like these flowcharts. Bear with me, this will take 1 minute precisely. Probably the most influential forums in the way in which UNRWA decisions were made, policy was made, were the five standing technical committees. They were advising and formulating on policy. They advised the Central Committee, which then made policy decisions, and they contained representatives from the big four, US, UK, Soviet Union, and China. That represented most senior and the most senior and Anglo-American centric version of expertise and authority, and you'll see that there's a whole series of subcommittees as well. Secondly, there were the formal headquarters in Washington, which worked with the technical committees and the governments. Then there came several regional offices, which translated the principles into operational orders for their regions. I'm most interested in the most influential one of them in London, the ERO, European Regional Office. There's also others in the Middle East and in the Southwest Pacific, which was in fact based in Sydney. And then finally, there were the missions, UNRWA's missions, which are this pivotal unit that actually organized and carried out the relief work. But it's important here that the missions came notably low in this organizational hierarchy. They were conceived by the people sitting in Washington and to a certain extent in London, primarily as recipients of central orders and as distributors of stuff, of aid, to a certain extent of ideas. So within UNRWA, there were several clear and overlapping hierarchies of activity, of knowledge, of expertise, and we can see a general trend of a seemingly one-way dissemination of instructions downwards, from Washington, so downwards this kind of chart, from Washington to London to the missions, and from the missions to the locals, and eastwards, so from the US, UK to Warsaw, Prague, Belgrade, Tirana, and so on, Athens. And this clear hierarchy defined the relationships between Washington and the local administrators, and it more generally defined the relationships between donating and receiving countries. And it betrayed, to a certain extent, UNRWA's central diplomats' understanding of what development, or as it was soon to be called technical assistance, was like. It was rooted in a certain conception of backward agricultural economies in that crucial belt of southern, central, eastern Europe with technocratic, practical solutions such as the mechanization, fertilization, irrigation, soil conservation, technology, training. These are all solutions that could be kind of written, given in orders, and then simply followed out. So it was a matter of supply, technology, technique. But of course, this sense of a one-way traffic is highly misleading. It obscures important questions and details. There's many examples of receiving countries questioning or complaining about or pushing back against this Washington expertise. And in fact, this is part of a much bigger conceptual problem I'm dealing with in my research, which is how to write the receiving countries and the relief workers as the translators of these orders into practice into UNRWA's history. And thinking about marginalization and insiders and outsiders offers some opportunity to do that. So this is one kind of hierarchy that was embedded in UNRWA's structures. Another one is visible in the way in which different fields of UNRWA's work were ranked. Not all fields of what UNRWA did were equally valued. For example, the economists were indisputably the meta specialists. During the early planning stages and in UNRWA's predecessor bodies, they oversaw the detailed construction of levels of supplies and services in relation to need. And there was a vast array of specialists working with the economists or in their orbits, statisticians and lawyers and so on and so on. And then there were many other specialist fields that were represented and somehow wrangled for space in the relief project: agriculture, transport, industry, social work. And embedded in this hierarchy that was often unofficial and sort of implicit but clearly there was also a hierarchy, a gender hierarchy, as in who was carrying out and representing different fields. Medicine, public health, sanitation and related fields often appeared as largely autonomous, but perhaps not nearly as powerful as they sounded in accounts. I have to say, it pains me to say this because it undermines a key argument that I've made in my own work so far, but health and welfare here actually appeared as relatively marginal within the broader remits of economic planning and reconstruction. Perhaps this is surprising to those of us who may have been tempted to take the public health activists at their word, but I would like to hear what you think about this. It's fascinating to me that Wilbur Sawyer, UNRWA's director of health, later in 1947 made a historical, so a longitudinal argument for the importance of UNRWA's public health. In the 1947 article, he listed annual budgets for the League of Nations Health Organization, for the Health Division of the Rockefeller, for the United States Public Health Service, and for the WHO Interim Commission, and UNRWA's was largest by far. So he concluded that in comparison, this brings out the magnitude of UNRWA's total expenditures for health. And he said they had to be large because the requirements for relief services was huge and it was based on an unprecedented emergency. But this didn't, in fact, reflect discussions within UNRWA, where different fields were pitted against each other and cases had to be made of based on which priorities resources were to be spent. So just because UNRWA's health operation was larger and more expensive than that of the League didn't make it larger and more expensive than other parts of UNRWA's work. And this is something that I've been struck by really quite recently, and let's discuss it further. These internal hierarchies and rankings are important, and then they are partly reinforced by relief workers' practical experience of relief work. And so in the remaining time, I want to mention two other processes that created insiders and outsiders in what UNRWA did. The first concerns infrastructure, technology, transport and communications. Many contemporaries thought that UNRWA's project was a perfect illustration of what a new connected, scientifically organized world could look like. And indeed, there were virtual armies of relief workers setting out on ships, on planes, on trains to travel between the various outposts of UNRWA's network. Just to give you some numbers, in May 1946, 16,000 cables and telegrams were flowing in and out of HQ in Washington, and 13,500 incoming and outgoing cables were handled by the branch in London, by the communications branch in London. This is a vast amount of communication and messages sent backwards and forwards. The world certainly seemed a lot smaller and more connected. But this undoubted connectedness obscured great inequalities and significant holes in communication and transport, and immediately created outsiders that were left behind. When the UNRWA missions arrived, parts of the communications infrastructure, such as telephone and telegraph systems, were completely or largely destroyed in stretches of central, eastern, and southern Europe. Partly this was, of course, a product of scorched earth as it had been applied. Consider, for example, these images of the so-called rail wolf or sleeper's plow in action, which were destroying Soviet railway lines during the German retreat and which created actual outsiders. And partly it stemmed from longer-standing inequalities and differences. So picking up on the railway example, you'll know that the Soviet Union had a different gauge rail network, which meant that those travelling from west to east had to change trains at one point, from narrow to broad gauge, and those travelling the other way, vice versa. This affected the around 1 million or so Polish repatriates, which are photographed by an UNRWA photographer here, changing trains, moving from east of the River Bug to the new German, former German territories of Poland. But it also affected UNRWA's personnel. And these kinds of images are really important, I think, for understanding the many examples of UNRWA workers describing their locations as outposts and their contacts as outsiders, because they weren't connected and, in their view, just couldn't do their jobs. Just to give one short example, July 1946, schedule of transmissions from London to various European and Asian points showed that communications was by far slowest in parts of Central and Eastern Europe. Singled out were Belgrade, Budapest, Kiev, Minsk, and Tirana as the black holes where messages were sent into and nothing ever came back. That an exasperated note was included. I quote, "The mission at Kiev, although it had the use of the Soviet government diplomatic pouch for 5 weeks, underlined, after its arrival in March 1946, received no official mail." This created huge problems. It was in the areas most suffering as a result of the destruction of infrastructure that were now most cut off and out of the loop. And it was precisely those areas where UNRWA had to carry out the bulk of its work and manage a very difficult and contradictory set of messages of need and deserving and success. So lack of technology infrastructure created physical outsiders. Those left behind by being unconnected and unreachable. And finally, there was another crucial way by which outsiders were made in the course of UNRWA's relief operations. The receiving countries all had to conform to a certain way of going about demanding and receiving, claiming and receiving supplies, and working with UNRWA's officers along the way. Everyone, to be sure, wanted the goods, the stuff, but relief workers were often quick to judge whether their contacts from national and local governments were willing to collaborate with them or not. Their relationships with local officials were directly informed by how much they were able to negotiate their way around the receiving country's bureaucracy, and whether they could spot familiar political and administrative institutions. Interestingly, this didn't always coincide completely with the degree of physical destruction or economic development, although they were important factors. And it didn't necessarily correspond with the later geography of the Cold War. In fact, at the beginning, relief workers seemed to confront a division, broadly speaking, not so much between Eastern and Western Europe as between Northern and Central parts and those in the South. The mission in Czechoslovakia, for example, was, according to the official historian, UNRWA's official historian, I quote, "one of the most competent administratively of all the receiving countries. It had the organizational machinery and ability to carry out its part of the UNRWA work, the distribution and utilization of aid without constant intervention and nursing by the mission." Material conditions were significantly worse in Ukraine and Belarus, but even here, relief workers reported that there were competent ministries and well-run technical organizations they could work with, and that they were staffed with officials who had training, who were capable, who were willing to take charge. This contrasts very sharply with reports from Greece, some of them from Yugoslavia, and of course from Albania, where relations were really rather more fraught. Already in her preparatory lectures in London, one UNRWA worker, Rhoda Dawson, was told that not much could be expected from Greece. And I'm quoting here from her diary, from her notes that she took at the time. "Yugoslavs tend to be very efficient in self-government," she wrote, "but Greeks less successful, no good organization, spoon-fed, paid, not good workers." The mission in Tirana, too, filed frustrated reports about their unhelpful relationship with the Albanians. And according, again, to the official historian, Woodbridge, quote, "gave up trying to discover the causes of the government's bewildering shifts from a relatively cooperative attitude to downright obstructionism." So there were clear differences in political and administrative systems, and the relief workers were very quick to judge the degree to which they could navigate them. And then these different relationships with local officials quickly intermingled with relief workers' own subjective feelings of cultural affinity and solidarity and sympathy, or lack of them. So to conclude, this us and them insider-outsider binary is a really important one for relief work, for aid. UNRWA, like so many other organizations, operated in some ways like a club. It had a gate to membership and entrance. It had set rules and required behaviors. It's true that this stark binary of insiders, outsiders probably isn't that helpful for grappling with some of the more slippery intermediate categories. But I think it can be a very helpful reminder to pay closer attention to power and to hierarchies and to testing which fields of activity and with which groups were pushed to the margins and by what processes. In some ways, UNRWA's public health work in parts of southern and eastern Europe was doubly marginalized as a result of political geography and of disciplinary hierarchies. Ultimately, I guess I want to leave you with the idea that there's these a number of overlapping hierarchies within UNRWA, but the question of perspectives is crucial here. To relief workers, outsiders were defined primarily by practical and by political inaccessibility and by a lack of willingness to play along. Thank you.